him through a mutual friend at a treatment center, and didn't know him very well until about 2 years ago, and out of the blue I received a phone call from him for something that ended up changing my life. But since then, since these last 2 years, I've had a lot of contact with him, and he's got really good sobriety. He's my boss, which is actually both good and bad. Because when I'm at work, sometimes I bring problems at work that are not work-related. And it's really nice to have an ear to be able to talk to while still doing the job. And sometimes I get distracted and then I pay the price, but it's all good. But you came here to hear him tonight, not me. So without further ado, here's Johnny.
I'm Johnny, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date, February the 17th, 1988. Central is my home group. Going to be a little bit of what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. We're not all here because we sang too loud in church. We're all here because we drank too much alcohol and drugs, and we did a whole lot of wrong. So I'm just going to share on a little bit of my childhood. I'm not going to draw it out because I'm going to spend more time tonight on how it is today and how I got here. You know, I look around the rooms and I see people, I think gypsy, and not a whole lot of people that was in the little Joe over there, in the little house over there. You know, February 17th, 1988, when I came back to this program, it was 5:30 in the morning. And there was an old man opening the door over there. His name was George Smith. Some of you may know him. But he looked at me that morning, and he said, "Johnny, there's two people that can't get sober and will never get sober. And excuse my French here, because I'm going to tell it just like he told me." He looked over them black glasses. He said, "A smart ass and a fucking know-it-all will never get sober." He said, "And you're both of them." 2 weeks prior to that, I'd have probably wanted to slap the old man. But I looked him in the eye and said, "Yes, sir, you're 100% right." That was a moment of clarity when I got honest with myself. And I was introduced to this program back in 71. So y'all do the math. People that just raise their hand for 30 days, y'all just keep coming back. Because George told me the day he died, at 5 o'clock that afternoon in the nursing home, he asked me about three people. And I said, "They're all drunk." He shook his head and said, "Okay. Don't ever give up on them, because you don't know when it's going to take." They didn't give up on me from 71 to 88 when I kept coming back in and out, in and out. So you people just keep coming back. This is amazing that I can stand in front of a room this full and talk. Because when I was a child, I was shot right here. And they didn't take the pellet out until I was 7 years old. And to do a book study report in school, I'd have to look that way. I couldn't look at the students because I'd get stuttering real bad. So I'd always have to look at the blackboard. So it's amazing today I can even look all at y'all and talk. I was born in North Florida, raised up in a little town called Havana, Florida. That's just north out of Tallahassee, about 12 miles from Georgia. So I have a little Georgia, I believe, in me, and a little bit of Floridian in me. Everybody tells me I have one hell of an accent, but I've had to wear that all my life, and that's okay today. When I was 1 or 2, 2 and a half, 3, starting to get around, it was funny. And I started noticing that I had brothers and sisters, but I didn't live with my brother and sister. I lived with my grandmother and my grandfather. I was the baby of the family. I saw them on the weekends, and then they'd leave, and I didn't see them Monday through Friday. So, as I got a little older in school, I asked about a father. And they said, your father died of a heart attack. And I just left it there and never inquired about it. You'll get to that later on with this. So anyway, I was living with grandmother and grandfather. Mama had the rest of the kids at the house. So she had a handful, couldn't take care of me because I was the youngest. She worked 2 jobs. But I had, growing up, my grandmother and grandfather. My grandmother was the head of Eastern Star, church on Wednesday, church on Sunday, Monday. And my father worked for the railroad. I remember every morning there was fresh bread being made. My granddaddy wouldn't eat day old bread. Grandmother had to get up and bake bread every morning. At the end of the night, granddaddy'd take everything left over, put it in a croaker sack, take it down the railroad yard for the hobos to have stew. Excuse me just a minute. So he would have lunch with the hobos. I remember 5 or 6 going down to the railroad yard with him and seeing the old hobos down there. Because I'd go down with him and he'd take blankets and clothes from the church when they brought to him. And I'd see the old hobos sitting down there and saw how happy they were to see him because they knew they had some clothes and blankets and everything coming. So that kind of stuck in my head. As I was being raised by my grandmother and grandfather, I was taught no matter what we had to do, if somebody needed help, we stopped doing what we did for us and went and helped them. You know, Mr. Brown, 10 miles down the road, got hurt. Couldn't take care of his place. We did our chores and went and took care of his too. So I was taught good. I was taught right. And getting older, my grandfather died. I was 12 years old. Always during school, I'd hear on Monday these kids talking about hunting and fishing with her father, camping out. And I kind of envied that, you know. But I did all that stuff. Me and granddaddy went hunting. Me and granddaddy went fishing. We went camping. But I would just hear the kids, what me and my father got to do this weekend. It just kind of stuck in my craw, you know, that I didn't have that opportunity to do with my father. But I had it to do with my grandfather. So I'm about 12 now. My grandfather died. And I was starting to go hang out at the bowling alley in Tallahassee. Wasn't too long after that. Wearing my penny loafers and blue jeans and white T-shirt with a packed cigarette rolled up in the sleeve where you could see the red Lucky Strike in the side there. And I thought I was being cool, like the rest of the kids. And then, 13, my oldest brother would drive through the bowling alley with some of his older friends, and which his older friends' brothers were their younger brothers, my age. So they'd come flying through real quick and throw us a six-pack of Falstaff back then, or Slits. And we'd drink one of them, and then I felt like King Kong after the first one. Man, this was amazing. And then the second one, I felt like I can take on the world. And I remember that night, after two beers, being in a fight at the bowling alley, and the police coming and picking me up, and at that time, taking me back to Mama's house, which I hadn't been with Mama for a long time, or hardly any. So I was starting to get the road act from her about what I was doing, and then I just got to where, you know that, what Mr. Smith said, that smart ass and that know-it-all, well, that's what I was, so I didn't listen to her or anyone else. And that's when my life really started having its up and downs. I really did enjoy sports, football only. I hated basketball, and I didn't want to play baseball. But I did like football. So I would try to maintain grades enough and try not to drink or, and at that time I was so naive, I didn't even know nothing about drugs. But I'd try to stay out of trouble to where I could stay on the football team. And I was going through junior high and high school, and I guess she was my first high school sweetheart. She ended up pregnant, and I ended up going from Tallahassee to Bainbridge, Georgia, on a Sunday. My mother driving, Susan in the back seat with her two parents, me up in the front seat, and Dick, my father-in-law, holding a shotgun. And it was truly a shotgun wedding. He said, "You will marry my daughter, and you will take care of that child." Well, 8 months into this marriage, we both looked at each other and said, "You know, we've had enough." We were just like two cats thrown in a croaker sack, and it was fixing to be death. I mean, our son was just born. So she went and got a lawyer for a divorce. I showed up at the lawyer's office signing papers. He said, "John Franklin Powell." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Your father was Eugene Powell." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "He committed suicide. You were 3 months old." I'm going to tell you, folks, that felt like a hot rod iron going through my heart, through the back of me. And the first thing that came to my mind is how I hated my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother, and every brother and sister for lying to me. So I confronted. They said, "Well, you know, we didn't think you'd understood suicide." Might not have. But you know, that was 3 or 4 years of age, you was telling me, heart attack. Sometimes somebody could have said it right, tried to explain it to me. But I guess they did the best that they could back then. The best they probably knew how to do back then. Let me put it that way. Because I have forgiven them all. It really took me back and started looking at some of the stuff I was raised and thought when I got back into this program and doing this program. But anyway, I could see my mother in a grocery store, and I wouldn't even say hey to her. My brother came back from Vietnam, Gene, and me and Gene used to love to hunt and fish. Well, when he came back, we went fishing, Lake Jackson up there in Tallahassee. And I pulled out a set of syringes and was going to shoot some coke. Some of my little story will be about drugs because it was there. But 99% of my problem was alcohol. He hit me upside the head with a boat paddle. We fought in the lake, and then we didn't speak up until 7 years ago. No, 9 years ago. And it was because of me doing drugs. I started going to jail. And then I ended up in ACI, which if nobody knows what ACI is, Apalachicola Correctional Institute. Back then, Louis Wainwright was the director of all the state of Florida correctional centers. And his wife was one of my mother's best friends. So she said, I just tarnished the whole Powell family name. And she wouldn't even have nothing to do with me. Which, oh, that was okay, really, because I didn't, at that time, really have a whole lot to do with any of them because being treated the way I was. You know, that's alcoholic, you know, I really took that shovel right there and started digging a lot of holes, blaming a lot of people. And I rode that horse for a long time. So I was introduced to my first AA meeting, and I'm sure the only reason I went to it is because they said, y'all can get out of your cell, go to a room, and there will be coffee and donuts there. So I knew the only reason I got it, said yes, I want to go to a meeting is because I wanted some coffee and donuts. Well, there was two guys that came from Tallahassee to do the meeting. Tom Duffy, he won't mind me saying his name. Over the years, me in and out, you'll hear that name some. And Jerry Smith. Well, Jerry Smith was actually an inmate at ACI for many, many, many years, actually 29 years. And then when he got out, he started the AA meetings up there. So they would come once a month and do an AA meeting. And I would get out just to go have coffee and donuts. When I got out, the first place I went was not an AA meeting, I can tell you all that. First place I went was to get drunk. And it didn't take very far to go. Because leaving ACI and being real grown up and run the woods of Bluntstown, I knew right where to go and get in Bluntstown and just knew what kind of trouble I could get into, too. So, it wasn't an AA meeting I went to when I got out. I went back doing same stuff I'd done to get me in there. And you know, when I walked out of ACI, it was funny, I looked back and I said, I'll never come back here again. And I hadn't been back there yet. Been in jail many a time. Did enough to deserve to go back there. But I hadn't been back there yet. I say yet because, you know, there is still things for me to end up doing that I hadn't done if I don't continue doing what I'm doing today. And I know that. So for you people of 30 days bouncing in and out, there was my road. 71 introduced this, 88 my sobriety day. Many times in and out, in and out. 2 years here, back out. Year and a half here, back out. Everybody always asks me, you got a sponsor? Yeah, I got one. I didn't have a sponsor. Yeah, you know, I was reading that big book and reading parts of it that I wanted to read. And I had a sponsor. It was called, his name was Johnny, so, you know, that was a dummy sponsoring dummy. And so that's why I ended up getting what I got, you know. And that was, I didn't get this program. So, for you people that have been bouncing in and out, in and out, this thing does work for people that work it. The world's full of it. This room's full of it. Every AA room meeting here in Orlando is full of it. But they're also full of the type persons like I was. You know, the doctor, in the doctor's opinion there, I was a type person that was unwilling to admit that I couldn't take a drink. Then there was, after a year, year and a half, I can do this without any danger. And after a year and a half, I can do this without any danger. Within 3 hours, be back in jail. Now, if that's not insanity, see, I've got this little BB brain that will tell me. It's the same brain I was born with. They ain't done nothing to it. And it can still tell me at times, Johnny, it'd be okay to go do this. And I just don't believe my lies today. You see, I used to believe that, well, if I'm telling myself it's okay, that can't be a lie. I'm telling myself it's okay. They said, you got to be honest, watch what... A lot of people, I got to be honest and watch what I say to myself. Because I can tell myself the biggest lie and believe it. And then I'm off to the races. You know. If a grown man had done to me what I had done to myself, I would be back in ACI right now with a life sentence. But I'd repeatedly do it to myself over and over. I came back in this program. I'm going to tell you how I got here. It surely wasn't because I wanted to get sober that morning. That wasn't my thought no more. I was that hopeless case. The promises worked for other people, but it wasn't going to for me. I was that person that was unable to be honest to get this thing. So, February the 17th, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was in Taft, where I lived, out in the woods out in Taft. Thank God Old Dixie Fried Chicken was there, because that's where I ate supper. Me and the cats would fight for the chicken at night. Just as long as I'd share it with them, they were okay. They'd let me come back next night. But at 3 o'clock in the morning, drizzling rain, 27 degrees. I was on my hands and knees praying. Like I thought you're supposed to pray, you know, you're on your knees, your eyes shut, hands folded. I was at a bench stop. And I was praying and telling God that I was asking God for forgiveness, really. I wasn't praying to Him to get me here or get me sober or... I was asking Him for forgiveness for what I was fixing to do. Because the Amtrak train comes about 5:30 in the morning down there. And it comes by at a rate about 70, 80 mile an hour back then, speed. Because I lived, about from here, the house is over there, from the railroad track, and when it used to come by so fast, I could feel the ground shaking. So it came by pretty quick. So I knew that morning I could stand out in front of it and be a hood ornament, and everything would be over real quickly. And that's what I was asking God's forgiveness for. To forgive me for taking and fixing to end this miserable life and leaving the kids and the children that I hadn't been a father to. Leaving the brothers and sisters with the turmoil of the way life was for us, between us all then. So I was asking for His forgiveness for this. As I was asking for forgiveness, and like I said, I had my hands folded and my eyes closed, I heard this voice over an intercom. He said, "You have to move on." I jumped up and I looked up. I started walking. And I saw these headlights. I looked over my shoulder. It was the Edgewood policeman. I said, "Thank you, God. He gonna pick me up, take me to jail. I'm gonna get to eat for 2 or 3 days. I'm going to get out of the cold and rain. I'm going to get my pants washed. I've been pissed in for a couple of days and pooped in." I said, "Thank you, God." So I'm walking, just waiting for the blue lights. "Come on, come on. Hurry up and get me out of this." Well, about 2 blocks later, he turned around and left. And I was pissed off. I said, "You son of a bitch." Because 2 weeks before that, he'd picked me up when it was 80 degrees and nice weather. And took me to jail because I was stumbling drunk down the sidewalk, falling into Orange Avenue. So I was mad that morning. And I started walking, and I walked. And that's when I ended up at the back door of the little house. And there's George Smith opening and raining, and he saw me come through the woods. He said, "Johnny P, come on in here." And he made coffee. And he'd pour me a cup of coffee, and I spilled it. And he poured me one little swaller, and he'd help me get it up. I drank it. A couple more swallows, and I'd go out back and throw it up. I'd come back in, and he'd help me drink some more. And that's the morning he told me, he said, "Johnny, there's two people who never get sober." And that's what I'd been all my life, a smart ass and know-it-all. Nobody could tell me anything. Had all kind of counselors try to tell me. Had all kind of smart people tell me, "You're your own worst enemy." But I'd keep doing it, doing it, doing it. But that morning, I got honest with myself and I got honest with this program. Joe Cade was called by George. Joe showed up down at Central, and he looked me right straight in the eye, and he said, "Johnny, you can get sober. I'll find somebody else to keep me sober." And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, you can get sober. I'll find somebody else to keep me sober." So I've been watching you the past 4, 5, 6 years in and out, and you've kept me sober. Every time I might think I want to take a drink, I look how pathetic looking you are. And how sick looking you are, and how you stink when you walk back up here, and that reassures me that I don't want to go out and take a drink. So I was kind of pissed off at him then. But I was told by Bill Oakley, George, Tom Blair, Many of them. If a sponsor didn't piss you off, you didn't have the right sponsor. And Joe pissed me off many times. And I did piss him off many times. But I did get honest with Joe, and I worked these 12 steps of alcohol and all with Joe. He had me read daily the doctor's opinion. Daily how it works. And that's when I started studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I found out that you just don't work this stuff and put it on the shelf. It is a textbook. You know, if I want to be an electrician, I got to go to school and have a bunch of books and study them and study them. I still have to study this book of Alcoholics Anonymous today. Because I am all in it. And I still have that little BB brain. That when I think, you know, I don't need to do this, or I don't need to do that, that's when that little thing tell me, but it'll be okay to go do that, I can believe it again. I like to look back on my life, and I do a lot. I was thinking about it before I came down. I was reading a big book, and I do what I call a little resume look. And I was thinking 20 years prior getting here in 88 and from today. I hadn't been locked up. I hadn't slept outside and ate out of a Dempsey dumpster. I hadn't pissed in my britches. You know, I got a pretty resume today compared back from 88 to 20 years beyond that. Went to jail, eating out of the empty dumpster, doing harm to other people. So when that little BB brain of mine can tell me things, I can tell it real quick today. Shut up. I don't believe you. You know, I know different day because I have got a resume to show me the difference. I've got this fellowship and people that I can talk to that will tell me the difference. Joe told me, he said, I had a problem with God. Share a little of my God stories with y'all. Because I was, even though I was brought up, my grandmother, head of Eastern Star and church and all this, they still were some things that I was taught young by my grandmother and grandpa. And I was taught prejudice from a young age. I think back in the 50s and 60s, I think a lot of people were. You know? And I carried them up to my older years in life. But looking back on it all now, having a God is my understanding today, which I told you. I left and started doing my way, so I didn't take that path of righteousness, the fork of the road that maybe some people take. You know, it goes the right way to live a good life, and then you go this way and you have the life I have. Well, I didn't choose the life of the good way at first, but it brought me back. This program and the way I live today brought me back to that road. And some of the things that I was taught, and I did believe back in early age of life, I don't today. You know, I do a lot of pig roast at different events. And that's why I'm going to share this. because I'm not a prejudiced person today, but I was at one time, and I belonged to something back then that I would not facilitate with today or approve of today. But as a young man in Bainbridge, Georgia, I did join a club, KKK, and that was the way I thought back then. But it's not the way I think today, and I'm not a prejudiced person. A couple years ago, and this was a God calling, and I had a problem with God now when Joe kept saying, Johnny, just keep living a good, orderly direction. Work these steps. Just believe that I believe, and you will develop and find a God of your understanding. He told me, I want it to be a God of your understanding. I don't want it to be a God of my understanding because I'm happy with mine. And he was right. I did find the God of my understanding. I was cooking some pigs out at Spirit of Life at the recovery center out toward Mount Dora. And there was a spiritual band out there playing. And there was a black drummer. And he come up. He's looking at the pigs and everything. He said, can you cook pig good? And I said, well, I've been told I can cook pretty good pigs. So I guess if you can play them drums as good as I can cook pig, you're going to be a good drummer. So anyway, we had a beautiful day. I was down in South Florida about 6 months later, working Action Gear Tire. We got tire stores down there. And I get a phone call from Pastor Wilcox. He said, Johnny, I'm Pastor Wilcox, drummer that was at Spirit of Life. I said, yes, sir, I remember. He said, our church up here in Daytona is having a first-year anniversary. And I asked the congregation what they'd like to do. And he said, there was a lady in the back that said, Pastor Wilcox, because she was at the Spirit of Life, she said, do you think you can get that pig cooking boy from Orlando to come over and cook us some pigs? You know, now I'm driving back from South Florida. And I said, God, this is definitely a God calling. You know, back in the late 60s, early 70s, that wouldn't happen. I was taught some things and kind of embedded in some things that I don't believe today. I said, Mr. Wilcox, I would love to come cook a pig at your church. So it was in July, actually, because I went over to the night race on Saturday and then got home loaded at 3 in the morning, loaded the pig cooker and the pig and everything up, and went back that Sunday morning to cook a pig for a black church. And at the end of the day, I had felt better than probably any time I'd ever felt in my life. And I was loading my stuff up, and these women were, here, take some of these, take some of this. And they piled food on me, and I had the best day of sitting over there eating and listening to music with them that I ever had in my life, people. That was definitely God working. And wouldn't have happened back in the 60s and 70s. Or the 80s. I mean, 70s, 80s, it wouldn't happen. Early. I didn't have a God. I was still running on my own thinking. This book has given me a new way to live and a new way to think. And we're all equal, you know. We can all take a knife right now and cut ourselves. We're all going to bleed red, brothers and sisters. I can tell you that. And we all have to work this program just like everyone else. One step at a time, you got to do it. Life's good today. A lot of my way of thinking has changed. I was sitting there at the house know. Just, I'm not one that can tell you page such and such and quote it. You know, I can't remember the big book. I don't have it in my brain where I can repeat it just like it is word to word. But the doctor opinion really enlightened me what I was, and that I couldn't ever take a drink, and that I couldn't ever get sober until I did some certain things. And then into action, page 26, 7, and 8, you know, the big book is a book of design living for me. It's in there somewhere, in them three pages somewhere. I think it's on 28. It's my how-to book, how to live life. It's something that I got to do daily. Yesterday is history. Tomorrow is a mystery. Today is great. Like I said, I do a lot of these hog cooking. And when we cook out at the Spirit of Life, this past one we cooked four pigs out there. I got this little sign that the guys make out there, and it's called Hog Heaven. And we put it over the smoker. And I was looking at that hog, H-O-G. I got thinking, hand on God. Or God on hand. You know, 94, they looked at me and said I had a 50-50 chance to live another year. I was diagnosed with bone marrow cancer. Lymphoma and bone marrow cancer. Went through a year and a half of chemo treatment. They put me in remission. In 2001, it came out, and I went through another year and a half of chemo treatment. And the doctor said then, it's next impossible to put people in remission second twice, so you probably will die. I said, Doc, you do what you do, and I'm going to let God do what He does. And I'm okay with everything today. Because see, at this time, I'd made amends to all the kids. When made amends to my grandfather, grandmother, mother, and daddy, they're all buried beside each other, and I went to the cemetery and made amends to them. Told them how sorry I was for everything I did. And I made amends to my father, not even knowing him or seeing him. But yes, my sponsor told me when I was doing all this about men's list and fourth and fifth step, and I didn't have anything about a father down there.
Either.
Joe asked me, he said, what about your father? I said, Joe, I never met a man, so I don't know. I said, I resented him because he was blew his brains out and never was around. I was 3 months old. But what I do know, and came to find out, there was a bottle of George Dickel sitting at the chair he was sitting in, and a note, and that he had a drinking problem. So he was one of the unfortunate alcoholics back in that day that didn't get this program. He did what alcoholics do. Did what I was sick to do that morning. And who was I not to forgive him when I'm in here begging and asking people to forgive me? You know, I'm asking God to forgive me for all my wrong. I'm asking brothers and sisters to forgive me. So who am I if I can't forgive? And I looked at him and said, you're right. I went to the cemetery up there and forgave them all. There was a spiritual awakening that day. Because when I pulled in that cemetery, the Oakland Cemetery in Tallahassee, it was August, probably 100 degrees, and that cemetery is full of tall 60, 70-foot pine trees, and there wasn't a damn one of them moving. But I know, as I was doing the amends and everything, tears coming out of my eyes. I felt this whirl of wind, and I looked up, and there was a lot of these pine trees just waving. You know, well, nothing I did, people. It made the hair stand up on my neck. So, you know, you call it whatever you want. It was just quenches or whatever. But I have a belief today, and I know what it was. And it was that spiritual awakening. You know, I believe I had some probably in my drinking days. I was just too drunk or didn't know what they were. But I think we experienced some back when we were using drinking. I know today, as long as I do what I'm supposed to do, and I know I don't do it perfect, I'm not supposed to, but I do the best of my ability. But when I am wrong, I can admit it today. Because, see, I'm not that smart ass to know it all today. Years back, I wouldn't admit it or couldn't admit it because I knew it all. And there was nothing I did wrong. Everybody else was wrong. So I get through this program by the fellowship of it, which I love. I got 5 more minutes. I want to share this because I really believe in this. My sponsor believed in it. We're not loomed and groomed bunch. You get sober and you enjoy life. Roger, talking to him today. He's in Indianapolis for the race tomorrow. Roger came out of the program 3 years ago. I took him to the first Daytona race in sobriety. He was scared to go because he said, Johnny, I always went to races and I got drunk. So we went to the Daytona race. We've been to every race since then. And now he's going back to his hometown to enjoy life and go to the races. And he's been there since Wednesday, texting me all week long, sending me pictures. And he called me today and said, thank you for showing me that we can sober up and go and have a fun life. You know, and we can. I enjoy life today. You know, I thought I enjoyed it sitting on that bar stool. I always wanted a stock car race. Sitting on the bar stool. Never did it. Got sober. My sponsor said, here, take a race car. Let's go to Biflo. Start racing. They don't mean nothing to a whole lot of people, but I got half a dozen trophies at the house from winning races at Biflo and New Smyrna. I got to do something that I always wanted to do. But the alcohol and drugs wouldn't let me do. Sobriety let me do it. And I enjoy life, and I encourage people to go out and enjoy life. I wasn't here last week for my wife's meeting last week when she spoke. But I had a room, a house full of AA people over, and we had a cookout and was watching a race and enjoying life. And that's what this program has given me. That's what a God of my understanding has given me. And that's truly a blessing, because a person like me, at Saturday night, at 5 of 9, should either be locked up or in the hospital, stabbed or shot. Thank you.